The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the winter of 2009, retired general contractor Donald Burke of Ware, New Hampshire, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Over the next few years, he and his wife Marjorie chronicled their outings in the countryside, the night terrors and falls, and the instability and emotional ups and downs. When asked to describe the disease, he said it was like standing on melting ice. Marjorie uses a different analogy, shifting sand. And that is the title of their book, Melting Ice, Shifting Sand, One Couple's Journey with Alzheimer's Disease. Donald is now living in a dementia care unit, but Marjorie is here with us to talk about their journey together and the process of caring for a loved one with Alzheimer's. Marjorie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here with you.
Well, both you and Donald wrote chapters for this book before the disease made it too difficult for him to participate.
Yes.
Now, you tell us that you did a lot of your writing in the cafe at Gibson's bookstore. So what did that process look like for him? Was he writing on his own?
No, he'd be at home with a caregiver. It was part of my Marjorie's Monday, my 5 hours of respite for myself. And when he would write, it would be more him telling me, and I would sit at my computer and write down his words and what he was saying and try to analyze how he was feeling. And then I'd flesh it out a little more and read it back to him. And he would either tell me, yes, that's what I said, that's what I mean, or no, change it this way or that way. So while he didn't actually have a pen and a paper or his fingers on a keyboard, those are his words that he gave to me.
And were you hoping to get his feelings, what was going on for him as it was fading, I'm sure?
Yes. I asked the question, what's it like for you? Because I wanted to know myself how it was affecting him and then what I needed to do to be a better caregiver.
How long have you been married?
57 years this week.
Well, happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Well, it does read like a kind of diary, a journal, you know. Was this something that you thought of as a journey day by day?
No, I started writing a journal right when he was diagnosed, just for myself, to see what was happening, what the changes were, how I was feeling. And then when I did ask him that question in 2012, I thought, oh, I've got to pursue this. I didn't intend to write a book. It was just more to bring the two of us closer together and for me to understand better how it was affecting him.
Well, and he tells us who he is. I'm sure you know after 57 years of marriage who he is.
Yeah.
But he lets us know he can be stubborn.
Oh, yes, he can be very stubborn.
What were some of the ways that that challenged him, the stubbornness?
One of the most glaring things was his using his walker. He does not like to use a walker. That's for old people, he'll tell me. And he's not old, even though he is 84 years old. And so he'd begin to call me the warden because I was after him to do things that he didn't want to do. And his stubbornness would get the better of him.
Yeah.
And one of the more recent episodes with his walker has happened since he's been living in a facility. He was mad at the staff because they wanted him to use his walker. He went in his room, shut the door, and locked it, and said, no women allowed. So when I arrived to visit, they warned me he was grouchy, and I thought, oh, great. And they unlocked his door, and I went in, and he forgot he was grumpy because he was so happy to see me.
Mm, well.
He has a great sense of humor, and I think that has helped him through this a lot. He can make funny out of nothing.
That's a skill we all could use.
Yes.
Well, as you looked for ways to connect with him and to stay active, you continued to go on these little mini trips, little dates, you know, to the Concord Farmers Markets, to concerts, King Arthur Flower, stops by the Kentuckook River. Reading about your outings, it feels like a kind of celebration of New Hampshire. And it made me wonder how much memory is tied to place for you and for Donald.
I think a great deal is. because when I show him pictures in, you know, family pictures or just pictures in a book of nature, he will connect with a place that he remembers or something that takes him back to his job. He owned a construction company for a long time, a family business. And he can connect quite well with things like that. But they're long-term memories that are hardwired. Mm-hmm. It's the immediate day-to-day things. 5 minutes after we've talked about something, he'll ask me the same question again. Mm-hmm. It doesn't stay.
My mother has Alzheimer's.
I'm sorry.
My father, when she was first diagnosed, said that all of these parts of her past, you know, the things that used to make her angry or upset, they were fading away. And he said, it's like I'm falling in love with her all over again, which was so touching. Makes me want to cry now. But
that's all right. Tears are okay.
But that also that we become the vessels for their memory in some kind of way.
Yes.
You know, so what does that do for you? What kind of position does that put you in?
Sometimes difficult if I have to make little lies or fiblets about, you know, he'll want to know how so-and-so is, especially my parents and his parents. And he doesn't understand that they've died long ago. And so, yeah, they're okay. I just saw them the other day, or things are all right. So that's hard. But the connections when he remembers something special that we've done over the years, or something funny, those are very precious moments to me.
I want to go back to the funny, because there are parts that would be very funny if they weren't so sad.
Yes.
Like when you decided to sleep in separate beds after Donald started talking and thrashing in his sleep. He thought you were a squirrel.
Yeah.
In the bed.
I got kicked out of bed many a night, or I got whacked across the head when he thought he was chasing squirrels, but it was me. And then the funny thing that goes along with that, he likes to whistle. And so in his sleep, he started whistling, which didn't make for a very good night's sleep for me. So I did have to move across the hall.
Well, there's a poem that you have about leaving the bed.
So this is called From There to Here. How did I get from there to here? What prompted this move that feels so strange? From there across the hall to here? I no longer sleep there with him. Instead, I sleep alone over here. My beloved thrashes all night and talks in gibberish a lot. Too many times he thought I was a squirrel in need of attack. Whack across my body, a rude awakening at 2 a.m. From queen-size luxury there with eiderdown to keep us both warm, I've been demoted to orphan status here in a trundle twin bed, or so it feels when I'm alone. A black woolen camp blanket does nothing to soothe my longing soul. But now we both enjoy eiderdown over there and over here. New bed linens brighten my mood. My soul begins to sing again. But I'm still here instead of there.
It's Marjorie Burke reading from her memoir, Melting Ice, Shifting Sand. She and her husband began the memoir, One Couple's Journey with Alzheimer's Disease. Donald is now living in dementia care unit here in New Hampshire. There's a phrase that you use in the book many times. You say the essential Donald. You know, this idea that even as he is changing, there is still this essential Donald there.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
The real Donald is still there. It's deep inside. And it's a wonderful moment for me when I can connect with that, or he can find that, especially with his humor. But just those moments when the real Donald that I fell in love with a long time ago emerges, I get a smile, or he squeezes my hand or something like that, or just says something that brings back a memory. Mm. Like recently, I took him to the eye doctor for his annual exam, and he started talking to all the people in the office about Perkins School for the Blind in Watertown, Massachusetts. And he and his company did a lot of work at Perkins School for the Blind back in the late 60s, early 70s. He was telling people about working at the School for the Blind, but he was having his eyes examined. He made that connection. So that was a very special moment for me. I just knew, okay, my guy's still there.
His passage did become more difficult. I'm thinking of, you know, the frustrations he had with his cane and the walker and the dizziness he experiences.
Yes.
How about for you? How did the writing change for you over the years as you were working on this book?
It was very therapeutic. At times it was very hard, and I would sit in front of the computer and cry. But I persevered.
There's a lot here about, you know, you finding your own center. And I think this is one of the things that becomes very clear in caring for someone with Alzheimer's, especially for the primary caregiver, that you need to care yourself.
Exactly.
You know, you need to go to the well for yourself and replenish.
Right. I started out by taking a program called Powerful Tools for Caregivers that the Concord VNA offers. And out of that, the women, mostly women, that took this course formed a support group. And that support group still goes on. We meet twice a month, and we sit around with coffee and cookies and talk and share and laugh and cry. And then from there, I realized that I needed more help than that. I started reading a lot about the disease. I found the Memory Cafe at Granite Ledges, which is a fabulous program for both caregivers and care receivers. And then I found the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester also has a memory cafe where a similar format of refreshments and socializing, and then looking at art and trying to see what we see in the picture, what's going on, what do you think these people are doing? Why are they dressed that way? And the arts are the last of the senses that people with dementia lose. And so this is extremely beneficial for both the care receiver and the caregiver. Mm. And one of the funniest, again, here's where the essential Donald came through one day at the Courier. The theme for the day was architecture and buildings. And the first picture they put up on the screen for us to look at was the Colosseum in Rome. He looked at it and said, oh, that won't pass OSHA. So, yeah. And then I had to figure out, well, what am I going to do on my Marjorie's Monday? No doctor's appointments, no grocery shopping. What do I need for myself? And writing was part of it. Going and sitting by water, I find that very meaningful and restorative. Or going and sitting and looking off in the distance at the hills and mountains that surround us here in New Hampshire. And my faith, that's been very important to both of us.
Looks like both of you have been very, very active in the Episcopal
Church. We have.
For many, many years.
Yes.
But you reminded me when you talked about the art museum that one of the last things to deteriorate for many people with Alzheimer's is this appreciation of art and music.
Yes.
And you are just a regular couple. I mean, you're smart, you're active, you're interesting, you know, you have good lives, good families. Is it hard to put that out there in the world? You know, this thing that we would never regularly see as we pass someone sitting there picnicking by the Kentucky River.
Yes. I think We're woefully behind in recognizing and supporting families that are dealing with this. There are a host of resources out there, but there's not enough. And we're 5.4 million people in the country right now with Alzheimer's, and that number is only going to grow, and eventually it's going to bankrupt us in terms of care. So I think it's important for communities to begin to look at what they can do for their next-door neighbor or somebody at their church who's going through this. And not be afraid to ask, is there something I can do to help you? I might not want to come and sit with your loved one because I wouldn't know how to talk to him or her, but could I grocery shop for you? Or could I pull weeds in your garden? Or things like that. And I think for the most part, the caregiver would be more than grateful for that kind of offering from friends and neighbors. And so I think there's a lot of things people in our small towns around New Hampshire can do to help. And I think this is where some of the educational programs that the VNA offers are very beneficial, because they're doing a lot in terms of healthcare and community resources and services.
Well, Marjorie, thank you very much for giving us a glimpse.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Marjorie Burke, she and her husband Donald are co-authors of Melting Ice, Shifting Sand, One Couple's Journey with Alzheimer's Disease.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we spoke with Marjorie Burke, who, along with her husband, chronicled how they, as a couple, experienced Alzheimer's disease. Marjorie talked about taking Donald to museums and to concerts, and how the arts can be a pathway to connect with people who suffer with forms of dementia. This next story from the podcast Everything Sounds explores that idea.
I'm George Drake Jr.
And I'm Craig Shank. This is Everything Sounds.
This is Dan.
Dan Cohen, C-O-H-E-N.
He founded what we'll be talking about today.
A founder and executive director of Music and Memory.
With a name like Music and Memory, it focuses on exactly what you'd think. It's a nonprofit organization which uses personalized music to help improve the lives of the elderly or those in healthcare facilities. They've seen the most impact with one group of individuals.
It's especially effective for people with Alzheimer's disease.
Music and Memory has been bringing music to patients for almost a decade. They've seen drastic changes in some patients after increasing their access to music.
Dan saw an outlet for something truly different and potentially more rewarding.
So I called up my nearest nursing home and I said, I know that music's already your number one recreational activity, but can we see if there's any added value to totally personalizing the music for each resident? And they said, sure. And so I came in with my laptop and some iPods, and it was an instant hit with the individuals who were reconnected with their music.
They just want to bring some life and joy back into families' loved ones.
They've been watching their loved one decline, perhaps consistently over months or years. And so anything that they can do to bring pleasure back and to reconnect them with music and to have their mood change, or to see, even for someone who has very advanced dementia and they're not responding to, they may no longer recognize their own family members, and they may no longer be able to speak, but if they hear music from their youth, they will very often just awaken, start singing the music to almost perfect rhythm. And it's quite a sight to behold. And so families are really delighted, you know, when they see this.
Probably the most vivid example was a man by the name of Henry. His story is pretty standard as far as Alzheimer's patients are concerned. Most of the time, he was unresponsive and pretty much just sat with his eyes down at the table.
Hi, Papa.
Huh?
How you doing?
I'm all right. I'm fine.
Who am I?
I'm
Music and Memory brought Henry the music of his past, and filmmaker Michael Rosato Bennett came along to document his experience. You may have seen the clip when it first came out in 2012. It's from a movie titled Alive Inside.
Before Henry gets the headphones, his head is facing down. He's keeping to himself, and generally, he's uninterested in the people around him. When the music finally gets turned on, his entire demeanor changes. He sits upright, his eyes are wide open, looking straight ahead of him. And instead of sitting quietly, Henry hums along.
What's even more amazing is Henry after hearing the music. He's responsive and more alert than before. And when he's asked what his favorite Cab Calloway song is, he sings it.
Oh, I'll be home there for Christmas. You can count plans on me.
A man who spends most of his day quiet and to himself is all of a sudden expressive and coherent through the power of music.
What does music do to you?
Give me the feeling of love, romance. Right now the world needs to come into music, singing. You got beautiful music here. Beautiful, oh, lovely.
And even if you can't speak or remember things from 5 minutes ago, the music is still going to soothe your soul. I mean, it is food for the soul. And for people not to have access to their music, unfortunate.
Until next time, thanks for listening to Everything Sounds. I'm George Drake Jr.
And I'm Craig Shank.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Humans and rats have been fighting over territory for millennia. Rats destroyed crops and reserves in the agrarian age. They spread the bubonic plague, wiping out 25 million people in the Middle Ages. They proliferated in sewers and garbage as cities grew. Even after centuries of attempting to exterminate them with traps, dogs, cats, and chemicals, it looks like rats are winning. Or maybe not. Jordan Kissner wrote in The Guardian about a promising new biotech solution that is neither cruel nor toxic to pets or other creatures. And Jordan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you.
We have self-driving cars. We can keep premature babies alive. We can 3D print organs. Yet we cannot still control rats. What makes them so successful?
Well, most rodentologists that I spoke to when I was researching this story said without hesitation that rats are the most successful species and that they will outsurvive us on this planet. And I think the reasons for that are many. One is that they reproduce at really stunning rates. The female rats, they ovulate every 4 days. Rats fornicate many times a day. They can have many, many litters a year. And so there's this really exponential population growth that you see. They're a male and female rat, if left to their own devices, they and then their descendants and then their descendants' descendants could go from 2 rats to 15,000 rats in a year. Mm. So that's one way that rats are really successful as a species. The other is that they're highly adaptable. They can eat almost anything. They can survive in almost any conditions. The third thing is that they're incredibly neophobic, which means that they're afraid of things that they don't know. They're very cautious. They're very smart. They're animals of habit. And that protects them from a lot of environmental dangers. So they're very good survivors.
Well, you looked into some solutions, including one biotech company that is aimed at the first, reproduction. How are they doing it?
Yeah, this company that I got in touch with, they're based out of Flagstaff, Arizona, and the company's name is SenesTech. And it's run by two biologists, one of whom, the CEO, Loretta Mayer, was looking into solutions for heart disease in women after menopause. But in order to study that effectively, to study the postmenopausal female heart, she had to find a way to make lab mice go through menopause, because mice and rats and most mammals actually don't go through menopause. They are able to reproduce until the day they die. And so she had to find a way to sort of falsely induce menopause or infertility in mice. And when she did and published that research, she started hearing from scientists all over the world asking for that technology, that biotechnology, to be developed for pest populations. If she could find a way to adapt this formula she'd come up with, which she had kind of facetiously termed mousipause. If she could adapt mousipause for rats, she could have a drastic positive effect on people all over the world.
So that research continued, and she successfully has been able to create mousipause. But we've heard before of collateral damage, and maybe you can tell us cases of collateral damage of chemical treatments against rats. Isn't there a fear of using a biotech solution that may be able to get into the environment and have some other devastating effect?
Right. So our primary tool in terms of our efforts to control the rat population so far, really in the last 100 years, has been poison. We've been using an adapted version of the anticoagulant warfarin, which many people take as a blood thinner. And we've been using a what's called sort of super toxic version of warfarin and sprinkling it in sort of a bright edible pellet onto the ground wherever the rat infestation is. And the rats eat it and they die. And that has caused tremendous environmental damage. There's a lot of, as you mentioned, collateral damage where children, many hundreds of thousands of children are poisoned, accidentally eat this poison and have to go to the hospital every year because they've eaten rat poison. It's very bad. It leaches into the soil. So the anxieties about using a chemical or a biotechnological solution are reasonable. That was actually one of the problems that Mayer and SenesTech were setting out to solve. They wanted to find a chemical solution that was not going to have those adverse effects. So when they came up with, when they adapted Mousipause to their current product, which is called ContraPest, they made sure that, first of all, it has no effect on the rat other than making the rat infertile. They live out a normal life. They die by predator or old age or whatever natural causes. And if for some reason the ContraPest formula comes into contact with the soil or another animal eats it, it's broken down quickly into elements that are neutral. You know, it doesn't get into the drinking water, for example. It's also a species-specific drug solution. So if a dog eats it, it won't have any effect.
You mentioned that rats are neophobic. Is that the word?
Yeah, that's right.
So they're afraid of things that they don't know. Certainly they get plenty to eat in cities. So how is this administered? How do they get it into the rat?
Well, one interesting thing that they did was formulate it as a liquid rather than a solid. Rats have, as you're totally correct in saying that rats have plenty to eat in most parts of the world where they exist. That's why they're there. But rats have to drink 10% of their body weight every day to survive. So they're actually always prowling for something potable. And so the SenesTech team formulated ContraPest as a liquid because it was going to be much more attractive to rats for that reason. And they spent many years tweaking the formula to make it optimally delicious to rats. So it's fatty and it's sweet. And the way they install it is they leave the dispenser with nothing in it for several days so that the rats can get used to the dispenser because, as you mentioned, they're going to be afraid of it because they don't know what it is. So once the rats get used to the dispenser, then they put the appetizing liquid inside, and they've seen really good results.
From gruesome traps to developing predators to toxic chemicals, humans have been fighting rat populations for hundreds of years. We're talking with Jordan Kistner, who wrote in The Guardian about a promising new biotech solution that is neither cruel nor is it toxic to pets or the environment. Well, this woman that you profile, really, from SenesTech, she's a biologist and she's also CEO of that company. She's a really interesting woman. She said she describes her own philosophy as part Buddhist, part Girl Scout. And she seems really connected to animals. What about answering concerns about cruelty?
Loretta Mayer, the CEO that you mentioned, and her wife, Cheryl Dyer, another biologist who co-founded SenesTech with Mayer, one of their primary motivations, I think, in taking on this work was in finding a pest population control solution. So not just for rats, but they also want to extend this technology to dogs, to wild boars, all over the world. Finding a way to control pest populations without killing those animals in mass numbers. In their early tests, they were actually testing on wild dogs that were overrunning a Navajo reservation in Gallup, New Mexico. And it was because Mayer went up there and saw the numbers in which these wild dogs were being slaughtered because of their total overpopulation. And she said, well, I have to do something that will control their population and not lead to the horrible deaths of hundreds. They were slaughtering 500 dogs a month. And so it comes from, on their end, from a very, very deep sense of loving animals and wanting to find an alternative that won't involve their death.
So ContraPest has been tested in the New York Metro transit system, also in Laos and the southeastern United States. Just got approval federally from the EPA. Now where does it go?
Well, they're securing state-by-state approval. The last time I checked in with them, they had approval to put ContraPest on the market commercially in 11 states, and I think they're moving quickly. They're also, there's a lot of enthusiasm in Europe for this product, and so they're already moving towards licensing and accreditation so that they can sell in Europe. And they, the demand for their product seems to be unbelievable. They seem to be rushing to keep up with it, and they spoke of having high hopes of disseminating this all over the world and continuing to find other species-specific adaptations so that this technology can be adapted for safe and animal-friendly population control all over the world.
Jordan Kisner, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jordan Kisner, she's a writer based in New York. Her long read for The Guardian is called Man versus Rat. Could the long war soon be over? There's a link to read it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we're back with Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Hi, I'm Josh Ritter, and this is the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop.
Henrietta, Indiana, milk time. Locked the factory down and shut it up tight. My daddy and my brother and 1,600 others lost everything they had in the night. Daddy got a taste for the hard stuff. Henrietta, Indiana was dry. We'd ride out to Putney, he'd tell me he loved me. The drive home was always so quiet. He had a devil in his eye. Like a thorn in the paw, disregard for the law, disappointment to the Lord on high.
Virginia Prescott here with the singer-songwriter, musician, and novelist Josh Ritter, though he may say writer first, musician second. It was a song that spun into his 2011 novel, Bright's Passage. All of his songs draw deeply from the narrative traditions of American and Scottish folk music, which he studied after dropping out of the neuroscience program at Oberlin. They're little stories of character and place and wild prairies and snake oil salesmen and teenage lust and adult drifters quickly running out of road. By his description, his most recent album, Sermon on the Rocks, as messianic, oracular honky-tonk. We caught up with him at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord, New Hampshire, on the very day it was announced that Bob Dylan would be awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. So we focused on songwriting, and I asked him how a song begins for him. Is it the lyrics or melody or the ideas?
Every time it happens differently. I mean, I almost never keep track of how it happens. When you start out with a blank sheet of paper and your guitar, your piano, I feel like you're kind of a traveler crossing an empty space, and anything you encounter along the way is useful. It may not be for that single song, it may be for another song in years to come, but I find that tracking how I do it might make me suspicious. Oh, superstitious, I should say.
You do a lot of traveling, so do you have to establish any kind of creative rituals for yourself, like I'm gonna write from this time every day, or how's it work?
I long ago made the decision that I couldn't be picky about where I wrote. You know, I never have had really a desk. You know, my desk is kind of wherever I am. Airplanes, airports, on the bus, in the dressing room. You know, these are places. I have an office that I work at home. I just love being, you know, free to write wherever. And I like working when people are around. You know, it makes me feel like more productive if there's other people doing stuff. I don't know why.
Well, you've also done a lot of collaboration with other musicians, like Bob Weir's new record is the thing I'm thinking of in particular. So what is it like? Do you actually collaborate in the writing process with those people or just making the music itself?
Well, with Bob, one of the things that was really important to me was that I was trying to write songs that would match his voice and match, you know, who he was at this time in his life, and try and kind of capture some of the wistfulness with which he spoke about working as a ranch hand in Wyoming in the late 50s, early 60s. You know, I thought that was really exciting and kind of a rich ground to like write about. I'm from Idaho originally, so writing about the West was something that's always been in my head. With that, I would write a song and I would send it off to Bob, and Bob would take it and you know, sometimes write a whole new melody for it, insert like some lines that were more autobiographical. And for that, I found that the distance was really important. Being in the same room sometimes can slow both parties down. Thankfully, now we have the technology to send these these songs to each other and, you know, let stew on them a little bit.
Where do you find your inspiration? I mean, I'm thinking about this record, Sermon on the Rocks in particular, you know, religious parables, the influence of that. Mm-hmm. Is that something you grew up with, you pulled in?
I think one thing, I've always just been attracted to stories. Like everybody, there's some things that kind of grab hold of your imagination. I was raised in a fairly religious home, and those stories kind of... you know, in some cases, you know, you go to Sunday school and they're drilled into you. But as time has gone by, I've found that I speak in that vocabulary, but that it's also useful because, you know, biblical stories and are kind of cultural currency. You know, they're like, they're a way to tell a larger story in a short amount of time. You know, people can talk about like the overturning the tables in the temple, and you know, that leads you to a whole story, a whole bunch of metaphors that can come out of that. It's really rich ground for that.
Do you share your work along your process? I mean, you were talking about it with Bob Weir, but do you normally, like if you're writing music for someone else, obviously mm-hmm. you might share it. But a lot of songs that you've written, you know, other people have picked up and played. Mm-hmm. Do you share those along the way, any of your songs?
I think it's funny. When I never have an idea of whether the song is truly good until I play it for somebody. And it doesn't matter if I play it for one person or if I play it for like 1,000. If it works, it gives me a glow, a kind of inner glow, and I know I've hit the target. If it doesn't work, I know immediately, and I have kind of a sad kind of admixture of sorrow and embarrassment. So either way, but like, you know, sharing songs, especially early on, is something that I've really grown to love.
But you wait till you think it's done to share it?
Yeah, like, you know, as Bob Dylan says, you learn your song well before you start singing, you know. That's
what I think. It's so nice to talk with you on this day when Dylan won the Nobel Prize for literature. First time ever a songwriter has won that. What are your thoughts on that as a songwriter?
Well, I obviously agree with Dylan that songs are literature. I mean, they are written stories and they're poetry, and they're not lesser, you know. I mean, in fact, when we go back farther and farther into history, you know, songs, you know, whether it's the Homeric epics or these like great long bard tales told in Scotland over the course of days and days, were songs. I think the modern idea of literature may not encompass that all the time, but I think that it's important to acknowledge that songs are kind of the font of so many ideas.
So do you think it's kind of, I don't know, an official stamp on songwriting?
I guess it could be, whether it's that's needed or not. I think Bob Dylan would be happy not to have won, too. I don't think he even thinks about it.
That was my guess. So I want to go back to what you were saying earlier, but Dylan distracted me. How do you know when a song is done?
Well, I heard somebody say, I think it was Gary Snyder once said that, like, that artists know when to lift the brush. And I think that that's how I feel. You know, there's just a feeling, you know, when it's done, you know. And I tend to edit very, like, harshly as I go along. You know, I tend to polish a verse till it's kind of like a marble before I move on to the next one. Because, you know, each one vaults off the next, you know. You never know what you're writing about until you get that first verse or that first chorus. And then the kind of framework and the logic of the whole song kind of comes out.
What is the best piece of advice you ever got about songwriting?
You know, no one's ever given me a piece of advice about songwriting. You know, but I think one time I got the chance to talk with Springsteen, and he was working on his book at the time, and I had just finished my novel, and he said, you know, like, well, it's just like songwriting, and is it? You just put like the perfect word after the perfect word.
What are you reading or listening to now?
Right now, let's see, I've been really into haunted house books recently. I like Shirley Jackson, and I'm really into those, like, kind of haunted house, like, the conceit of a haunted house. I don't know why, but this whole, like, little tiny world that you're encapsulated in is so attractive to me, and it's very much like a song.
Josh, you have a lot of people's fantasy job.
Yeah.
But have you been harboring any of your own little fantasy jobs?
Oh man, there's so many jobs that I think would be fun to do. Like, I think it'd be fun to be an ambassador. I think that'd be really cool. I mean, obviously, I think being a full-time novelist would be a really exciting thing and also a big change. I think being a nurse would be something pretty incredible, although I don't have the chemistry to do it, and I don't think I'll ever get there, you know? But like, there's a lot of great jobs out there that I think would be kind of really cool. Although I think my job is, for me, just the best. I love it. I was lucky to find it.
Lucky to have you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Josh Ritter.
Thank you. That was awesome. Thank you.
I was coming home late from midnight to 8. The radio said that I'd be the place. Left 3 men dead. Made their escape by 9. Said the sheriff they'll be in the next day. Will we be able to catch them? Can they bring the dogs in? Can they call up the bureau? Do they have next of kin? Cameras came to my door. I opened it wide. They thought I was crying. It was something in my eye.
Josh Ritter, who Paste magazine named as one of the 100 greatest living songwriters. The 10-Minute Writers Workshop is a production of NHPR, produced by Sarah Plourd with help from Maureen McMurray. You can grab 10 or so minutes with Kelly Link, Richard Russo, Aaron Menke, and dozens of others when you subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. And if you're feeling the creative urge, you can begin by writing a review, which will help others find it, you know, when shared by word of mouth. Besides music from Josh Ritter today, we heard from Poddington Bear, Blue Dot Sessions, and Delay. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.
The lights, the lonely kid, the register, I see it all clear as a bell. I got a devil in my eye. Like a thorn in the fall, disregard for the law, disappointment to the Lord on high. Like a thorn in the fall, disregard for the law, disappointment to the Lord on high.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.